Is it a role reversal for you to be the author and not the editor or publisher this time around?
Yes, it's a big reversal. It's the first time it's happened to me, and it's very peculiar. I thought I knew all the psychological difficulties of being an author, having worked with so many for so many years, but it's really novel and unique. And, of course, the peculiar thing about it is criticism, receiving criticism firsthand and trying to comprehend it and understand it.
What are the big surprises? What has been surprising you most?
Well, I found out that most book reviews are, you know, intelligently written and usually very favorable, but they're not, you know, perceptive in depth. They don't talk about what you did, and that sort of disconcerts you. You feel everyone's going to see in the book what you put into it, and I guess that's rare.
You've called Q, Shakespeare's Book of Sonnets, the most mysterious book ever published. Why is it so mysterious?
It's so mysterious. First of all, Q, it's called Q, and so are many other books, because it's a quarto. And it's simply a code word or a shorthand for referring to the published book. And that's terribly important as against the individual poems, you know, the sonnets that circulated in manuscript, so-called samizdat, in the Elizabethan period, because that was 11 or 12 years earlier than the publication of the poems. My contention is that the poems are very early work of Shakespeare. Many Shakespearean critics claim that they're very late, but I think this is insane. The book was published very late. It was published 7 years before his death, and really at the end of his life. 1609 was the publication for Q, and 1611, The Tempest was performed, and he retired about the same time. He went back to Stratford. He did help on a couple of plays after that, Henry VIII and so on. But the poems, the contradiction is between this late-appearing book and this youthful work. It's mysterious in the sense that after its publication in 1609, no mention of it occurs in contemporary documents. The poems did appear in a sort of Baudelaireized and corrupt form in 1640, but the publisher, who was a pirate, John Benson his name was, He rearranged the poems. He put five sonnets together, five disparate sonnets he put together as a single poem. He pretended that Shakespeare wrote 76 poems. He gave them titles, and then he wrote a fake preface saying, Shakespeare oversaw this book. Shakespeare himself then living, vouched for the purity of this text, you know, big fat lie. And so there was, his name was still a household word, but that was 1640. Other contemporaries like Burton, you know, Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, the author of Anatomy of Melancholy, which is about 1620, no reference to the sonnets, just the same period, you see. And Burton was famous as a bibliographer and a collector of books. He had Rape of Lucrece, he had Venus and Adonis, he had every other quarto of Shakespeare's, but not the sonnets.
What do you think this is?
I think the book was suppressed. I think it appeared late in Shakespeare's life, as I say. By then, his friend, the Earl of Southampton, was in the, you know, one of the grandees, as they became in that Jacobean period after the peace with Spain. He was on the Privy Council of James I. He had merely to lift a little finger and the book would be suppressed. He was the subject of the poems, I think. I try to prove it. I think I present some pretty good evidence. It's all Shakespeare's evidence. Shakespeare wrote two letters to the Earl of Southampton. They're hardly ever referred to as letters. They're called dedications, which, of course, they are also. But they have the form of letters. They follow it quite literally, salutations, texts, closings. And you can even date them with the registration dates of those two books dedicated to him.
What references are there that the Earl would have wanted suppressed?
Well, again, he was a married man with a family. This was late in his life. And, you know, I'm not implying more than what the text implies, but obviously there's a mystery and some kind of strange story here, which is difficult to get at. And I've tried very hard to get close to the truth. Now, the big question, of course, the question about the sonnets is, was Shakespeare homosexual? And a recent writer, a very clever one, made a very witty statement about it. He said, Shakespeare was either heterosexual, homosexual, or bisexual. There is no evidence in the sonnets. Now, that's the first part of that is funny, but the second part of it is untrue. The only reason we even ask the question is that the sonnets make us ask it. These are poems written by a poet to a young man. They're love poems. What are we to make of this? The facts of Shakespeare's sexual life are well known. One of the few things we know about him is the fact that when he was a teenager, 18 years old, he married Anne Hathaway. They had a daughter a few months later. They had to get married, apparently. Susanna was born 5 months, I think, after the marriage. Anne Hathaway was 6 years older than Shakespeare, 8 years older. She was 26. They had twins about a year and a half later, the famous twins Judith and Hamnet. And the scholars point to the fact that two people in Stratford, where, of course, Shakespeare lived, was born and lived, grew up, there were two people who kept a shop in Stratford, and their names were Judith and Hamnet Sadler. And the supposition, and it's only a supposition, is that that accounted for the names of his children. Well, that's his, you see, the lost year, the so-called lost years of Shakespeare begin with the birth of the twins. That's the last public record up until 1592. From about 1582 to 1592, there's not a trace of a mention of anything by William Shakespeare, about William Shakespeare. In 1592, he comes into the public record for the first time, and what is it? It's an attack, which interests me very greatly. It's an attack by another writer. I start my book with that attack. It's Robert Greene, a dying playwright, a man who's dying in great penury and poverty. And he's very angry because this upstart crow, as he says, a new kind of playwright, who had begun as an actor, is now thinks he can bombast out as good blank verses, you know, you university man. He hates this playwright, among other reasons, because he's not a university man, as he, Master of Arts Robert Greene, is. He held that against him more than anything, which is...
There's a moral in this, isn't there?
This genius with words didn't go to college. Well, here he appears in the public record with an attack, and I think that he wrote Venus and Adonis. That was the next year, 1593. 1592 is this attack by Greene. 1593, his first book of poems. He had to prove that he wasn't just a playwright and just, appealing to the mob, to the vast audience. He was as good a poet as any university man, and he certainly was. He was better than any other university man, particularly Marlowe, who was, his first influence.
Let's go back to this question of Shakespeare's sexual persuasion. Of what importance is it to Shakespeare's readers and critics what his sexual persuasion is or was?
Probably none at all, but it's an intriguing fact about his life. And here are 154 poems, 126 of which are written to a boy. He calls him Lovely Boy. And the rest of them are written to a dark-haired woman with whom he is absolutely obsessed. That obviously is the affair. So at least he's bisexual, if the other is sexual. It isn't clear that the poems to the young man are certainly erotic, but I mean there's no evidence of physical relation. We just don't know. Maybe there was, maybe there wasn't, who knows? Except that one poem, the Master Mistress poem, is the only really, you know, sort of clear. May I read those lines?
Because yes, please.
They're part of the evidence that the critic I just quoted said, you know, there's no evidence in the sonnets that this existed, but what do you make of this?
Well, you're finding that, I'll mention the title of your book. Robert Giroux is my guest, a very well-known editor and publisher, and his book about Shakespeare is called The Book Known as Q, A Consideration of Shakespeare's Sonnets.
It's Sonnet 20, and it starts out by saying, "A woman's face with nature's own hand painted hast thou, the master mistress of my passion," so on and so forth. Because he ends up with a pun, and it goes, we think certain words are terribly modern, and, you know, we just in slang just discovered them last week, but many of them turn out to be Elizabethan. And he ends up with this couplet, and he's talking about nature. "But since she pricked thee out for women's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure," meaning I love you, but I can't use your love. I can't. That seems to me to say that love existed. And of course, love is an awfully complicated subject.
One thing I find intriguing about the possibility of Shakespeare being bisexual is that in America and in England, too, Shakespeare is kind of emblematic of high culture and of civilization and everything that makes humans superior. And homosexuality, on the other hand, is considered by many of these same people to be base, debauchery, everything that's kind of low and negative about human life. And the thought that Shakespeare was, in fact, gay or bisexual turns the whole thing on its head, and really, I don't know, it's nice to think about.
That's true, but I mean, Christopher Marlowe, who was a great playwright, too, was an acknowledged homosexual, wrote about it and made it very clear that he was. And of course, an artist can be or cannot be, and the fact that he's the artist is what's important, and how good an artist is he. But it really isn't proved that Shakespeare is homosexual, because there's another sonnet which I analyze very, very, homosexual in the physical sense. He obviously was in love with this young man, and I think I have an explanation for that. He was starting out a career. He was poor. He was unknown. In those days, to be an actor, which is what he was to be an outlaw. Actually, there was a statute on the books which said if you don't have the patronage of a nobleman and you're caught at it, you can be put to death. A third time, twice you're whipped, I think, publicly. The third time you're executed, imagine, just to be an actor without a nobleman's patronage. He found this patron, who was a very young man in 1592, if it happened in 1592, and obviously it happened in 1592, because in 1593 he published a book of poems dedicating it to the Earl of Southampton, who then was 18 or 19 years old. Shakespeare was 28 or 29 at that point. And I think the sonnets date from that period. They were written in a three-year period, because one of the sonnets talks about the 3 years since I've known you. Then they end with sonnet, that series ends with sonnet 126, and you go on to The Dark Lady, the very passionate physical sonnets, there's no question about that, including one of the greatest sonnets, I think, on sex ever written, or on love in that sense, The Expense of Spirit is one of them. And that's in the series to the Dark Lady.
One of the things you've done in your book is try to find out the autobiographical connections between Shakespeare and the sonnets in Q. And having worked with as many poets as you have, you've known their lives and their families and the people close to them and known their poems intimately as well. How does that knowledge of somebody's life affect the understanding and the reading of poetry?
Well, obviously, poets, like everyone else, are human beings, and human beings have autobiographies. And if they write, if they create works of art, their life, their autobiography gets into their work. There's no way it cannot get into their work. Even if they try to suppress it or distort it or keep it out of their work, that becomes apparent to readers. And true, the truth of art is what art is true. That is it, and it comes out. And a whole school of Shakespearean critics, one of the reasons I wrote this book really was to answer that school of critics. I call it the anti-biographical fallacy. I think it's idiocy to think that you can take these poems as literary exercises and analyze them that way without reference to the man's life. And of course, it's the product of the way in which Shakespeare is taught or has been taught for decades here and perhaps in England, and it's really too bad, because it's turned many young people and many readers who might find tremendous meaning in this work against him, because he becomes academic, dry as dust, stuffed shirt, a monument to literature. But as Colette said in a brilliant remark, which I never forget, Shakespeare wrote without knowing he was going to become Shakespeare. And of course, I mean, if he knew he was going to be as great as later generations thought him, he would have stopped writing. It would have paralyzed him, because writing is unconscious. A great deal of writing is unconscious. It comes from inner resources. And if you have a feeling of yourself as a great cultural figure, I think you'd stop writing. They say, that many Nobel Prize winners never write much after they win the prize. And not entirely true, but at least there's a grain of truth in that about Shakespeare. But poets, of course, poets cannot keep their work, their own ego, their own psyche, their own unconscious out of their work. John Berryman, whom I knew very well, poet, I was at Columbia College with him. We were classmates, and we studied under Mark Van Doren, our Shakespeare teacher, who really, if I have any qualifications for Shakespearean scholarship, it came through Mark Van Doren and through John Berryman. Why, John wrote a marvelous sentence at one of his essays. He said that many readers don't appreciate how much of a poet's own life goes into his work. And he went on to say, when Shakespeare wrote, "Two loves I have," he was not kidding. He really meant he was in love with two people, a man and a woman, in the sonnets. So that was a marvelous rubric, gave me a marvelous rubric to start from with this book.
Yeah, I just thought of what it is that interests me so much about the thought of Shakespeare being bisexual or homosexual at the same time that he's been this great symbol of civilization and culture. It kind of removes him from the hands of people who've made him this pompous symbol, and also removes homosexuality from the hands of people who are so anxious to think of it solely in terms of debauchery and
criminality.
Mm-hmm. One critic in reviewing your book described you as a detective in solving the mysteries of Q. Did you feel like a detective when you were doing
your research? I didn't feel like one when I was writing it, but I take that as a big compliment. I admire detective stories. I love to read them, of course. Everyone likes to solve a puzzle. And I suppose literary criticism is, in a sense, detective work. Understanding any piece of writing is in a sense, a work of detection. It's an intellectual process, and you try to find meaning out of contradictions and apparent contradictions and so on. So, but I didn't really start it out that way. It's true. I really knew a lot about it. I wrote the book. I started writing it in 1978. I had to give a lecture at Wesleyan University, and I had been making notes about the sonnets, about the publication of the sonnets, as a kind of bibliographical interest. And I suddenly thought, well, I'm going to talk about the sonnets. I want to get it out of the cliché department, so I'm going to call it The Book Known as Q instead of Shakespeare's Sonnets. I know that some critics in England are going to say, well, many books are known as Q. Well, I'm writing about this book known as Q, not the only book known as Q, but the book in 1609, which came out with some of the greatest poems in the English language. And my aim really was to, at the end, is to get readers, when they finish the detective work, whether they agree with it or not, and I don't know, I expect them to read the sonnets. That's really my main aim. And I reproduce all the sonnets within the book itself in their original form, the 1609 text, which is fascinating and tells you a lot. There's one sonnet, you know, that has two little pairs of parentheses under it at the end. It's only 12 lines, and the printer thought two lines had been dropped. Well, he was a good printer, but he hadn't read the sonnet because it is a different rhyme scheme from all the others. It was a coda, a wind-up sonnet, envoi, they used to call them, to a series. And those two little pairs of parentheses in the text prove to me, as a publisher, that Shakespeare never read the proofs. He never saw this book. It came out. That's another reason for thinking he may have had it suppressed. Mm-hmm. They were youthful poems. He never intended to publish them for the public. They were circulated in private. Here he is, about to retire. The book comes out. The Earl of Southampton is on the Privy Council. That's my scenario for the whole thing, is that at that point, they were suppressed. We've been trying to understand them ever since. The dedication by Thomas Thorpe, he's an interesting man. He interests me as a publisher, which, of course, I am too. He never had enough cash. He was always in trouble financially, but he had excellent taste. He published Marlowe, Christopher Marlowe, George Chapman, William Shakespeare, and about 26 books, which all of which we're still reading. And that's pretty good publishing, in my opinion.
Let me mention the name of your book again. My guest is Robert Giroux, and his new book is called The Book Known as Q, A Consideration of Shakespeare's Sonnets. And as you mentioned, the sonnets are also reprinted in this, and it's published by Athenaeum. Robert Giroux is one of the most respected literary editors of our time. He's been with Farrar, Straus & Giroux since 1955. He's now chairman of that company. He got a start in publishing with Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. And he's really edited some of the greatest novelists and poets of our time. And I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your work as editor and publisher. You've wrote recently that editors used to be known by their authors. Now some of them are known by their restaurants. Has publishing changed that much in editing?
Yes, it really has. So many editors, like myself, now appear on radio talk shows and television and so on, and perhaps we shouldn't. But I, like Shakespeare, I'm semi-retired. This is the end of my career, so I feel I can do it. But in the old days, editors were unknown. Their names are unknown. They were simply the midwives of publishing books. They were the people in the background who kept in the background and really should keep in the background, in my opinion, at least as long as, insofar as they're working with authors, they have to be that way. It has changed a great deal, but I suppose that's what life is, change. But now we do have some superstar editors who are very well known for their restaurants.
Who were some of the writers who you feel proudest to have been the first to publish?
Well, I'm proudest of the ones whose first books I published. You know, before it's not too difficult to discover recognized writers and to add them to your list, but to find a writer at the very start of his or her career, and there are 12 or 13 of them that I'm particularly proud of. One of them is Jean Stafford. Robert Lowell is another one. Hannah Arendt. I published her very first book, which Alfred Kazin brought to me at Harcourt Brace. Jack Kerouac, I published his first book. Bernard Malamud, and of course not only The Natural, his first novel, but I'm about to publish his newest one, which I think is a masterpiece, God's Grace. It'll be coming out in September. I published every one of Byrne's books from the beginning. Randall Jarrell's first book of poetry. Peter Taylor's short stories. Larry Y. Woody, his first novel. I think that's about, I can't think of every single one, but many other writers I've worked with, not from their first books. Isaac Bashevis Singer, for example. We acquired his work through the Noonday Press. Cecil Hemley had been his editor, but I just yesterday read a little note from Isaac in which he said, "You have been my editor for 22 years." That sort of shocked me. It's true.
What do you think makes a good editor?
Well, I think appreciation. An editor is not, he's a critic in that sense. And his role is to reassure the writer, to encourage the writer, but not to impose his ideas on the writer. The worst thing of all would be to say, don't write book A, write book B. The thing is, first of all, to find out what the writer is trying to do. Sometimes the best ones right away, almost right away, know what they want to do very, very clearly. And if you feel that it's not going to work, I think in candor and honesty you should tell them so and part company. But if you do work together, your role should be reassurance and friendly advice, sounding board. Interchange, dialogue, but of a minor, I think always of a minor character. If it becomes major and you say, no, do this whole thing all over, I think you're in the carpentry business. You might as well, you know, build the book yourself, write it yourself. Why have the author?
One of the demons that plagues writers is writer's block. And as you mentioned, you've worked with some writers over long periods of time and have been with them during their productive periods and the difficult times that they've been through.
Yes.
What does your role become as the editor when a writer who you're working with is blocked and is really suffering from
yes.
that?
It's a very common symptom and a miserable thing. I mean, for the writer, agonizing and difficult. And I have one piece of advice about that, the only really helpful thing one can suggest, and that is to turn to another work. And some of the best writers, you know, are always have at least five or six possible projects on which they're working. If they get stuck on project A, they turn to B. If they can't go ahead with B, they turn to C, and so on. Hemingway had marvelous technical, pragmatic advice for working writers, and that is, you know, work every day at the same time, if you can, preferably. And if you're going well that day, don't finish what you're working on. if you see that it's really going well, bring it almost to the conclusion. But don't finish it so that the next morning you'll start ahead of the game. You can then conclude what use the momentum of the day before and then go into another period. Because the hardest thing, the thing that causes writer's block is just sitting down in front of a typewriter and looking at a blank piece of paper. I mean, that is agony. Your mind should be working. The piece of paper should be forgotten. You mean you're so anxious to put down on it what's going through your head and to get the wheels turning that way. That's really the thing. I had an interesting experience soon after I came to Farrar Straus, and that was that Charlie Jackson, who wrote The Lost Weekend, was a writer on their list. I hadn't known him before then. And he had been suffering from writer's block for something like 15 years, 10 or 15 years, was a long period of time. And I'd heard about this. I didn't mention it to him. But after we got to know each other, he said to me very tentatively one day, would you take a look at my novel? I really would like some kind of reaction to it. I've only reached the halfway point. So I read it, and it was awful. It was just, compared to The Lost Weekend, it was no good. And I thought, well, I owe him an honest opinion. No other opinion is of any use to him. I told him how awful I thought it was. I told him to put it aside. And he flew into an absolute rage. He was absolutely so angry at me, he's ready to hit me. I didn't expect that intensity of reaction. I knew he wasn't going to like what I had to say. He canceled his contract. He left the firm, went back and wrote another novel, and it was a great success. So I broke his writer's block. I lost the author in the going. But I mean, that's the psychology. That's the way it works. I think writing is, and Charles Dickens said this, writing is energy, part of it. I suppose any artistic effort is energy. And Dickens had the greatest amount of energy of any writer ever alive. Look at the amount of work he put out. And Charlie Jackson couldn't recreate that energy. He was stuck halfway on the old novel. I released the energy by making him angry. His adrenaline began to work. And it was a different book. It wasn't the book I said was bad. He did put that aside and wrote another book.
Because you never know what kind of reaction you're going to get when you say something like that. And some writers' egos are so fragile, and some writers just are constantly alternating between feeling that their work is really good and will really last, and then feeling that it's actually really terrible and they'll never write again, and that it can leave you very unbalanced, that constant alternation. Do you have to consider the state of the writer's mental state at that time before giving the real honest feedback?
Yes, you do, and because I didn't know Jackson well enough, you see. Most other authors I work with I've known thoroughly from over great periods of years, and you get to know them. And of course, it's ego. Ego is what an artist is. He couldn't create if he didn't have that. Now, you have to be very, it's always a fragile ego. And you have to be part psychiatrist, you have to be part lawyer, you have to be part just good friend and somebody that they can exchange and have a dialogue with. Get them to relax is one of the hardest things.
And the stakes are high, too. Like with some poets, it's not that the block leads to neurosis, but maybe to suicide. And John Berryman,
even after great success, John, after all, won the National Book Award. He won a Pulitzer Prize. He had all kinds of honors, and so did Robert Lowell. Berryman was a suicide. Lowell wasn't. But Lowell suffered in other ways from a schizophrenia, terrible, terrible affliction. I remember him saying to me one, years after they discovered lithium, which helped him greatly, he said, imagine all the suffering I've gone through perhaps was just due to the lack of enough salt. And it really was disconcerting. That did help him, and but the thing about both those poets, you see, is what great work they turned out. They suffered, and they had illness, and they went through hell. But there's the work. It's with us. That's what their lives meant and what they wanted it to be. And I don't look on either of them as a tragic figure. Far from it.
You must have given considerable thought to the connection between madness and someone's creativity, like they're the source that it comes from. And I think it's fair to say that people are pretty divided on how connected those are. And
I'm not. I think they're closely connected. I think it was true in Shakespeare. I mean, back to Shakespeare, the poet, let's call him an apprentice poet. I think of him as a writer who's working out his career. Hamlet is a study in madness. I mean, the greatest poem about madness is that work, but pushing one's psyche or pushing one's unconscious to the farthest limits. Virginia Woolf is another example. I published Virginia Woolf. You know, she committed suicide in the end, this tremendously sensitive instrument that was pushed, had its periods of madness, no, but created all this work in the meantime. They're closely related. On the other hand, art, in another sense, is the greatest sanity possible, the greatest clarity, lucidity. When that's achieved, when it works, it's that. And when it's not working, perhaps it's the other. But illness, you know, Susan Sontag wrote a marvelous book called Illness as Metaphor. It's very related to creativity. And often people, when they start, many writers, when they start to write, go into a kind of depression and a malaise, which is a form of illness. But I'm not a proponent of this. I'm not suggesting it as a way of life. But I know from my own experience that it's true. But I mean, many people who don't write have terrible illness and neurosis and so on. So at least the creative person has the objective work which he creates to make up for the other.
So have you tried to be cheerful and optimistic with writers who are suffering with their work?
To reassure them, yes. I mean, they're very perceptive people and they can spot phony cheerfulness or, you know, Pollyanna approach. I just try to be honest. And I think if you're candid and, you know, specific and be as direct and straightforward as you can, as far humanly possible. It's not always possible. Things can get pretty complicated in detail and so on. But yes, I try to reassure them by one means or another, often by what would not appear to be reassuring. I mean, like my conversation with Jackson, I thought by telling him it was a lousy job, he might, something good might come out of this. Well, it did, and not for my ends, but for his own. It did. It isn't just cheerfulness. It's optimism in the sense of you see production at the end of it. It's productive. It's positive rather than negative in that sense. The goal is achievement of some kind. The achievement often comes through tremendous suffering and tremendous exertion of powers or sometimes waste of powers. A lot of waste motion goes into. But it's true of every art. You know, imagine actors. I often think acting must be one of the most difficult roles to perform because you're off the stage so much. You know, you're not being able to do what you can do as much as you would like to.
Say someone has a publishing deadline that's been set. They're supposed to deliver the manuscript to you, and they're at home wrestling with the demons, and the manuscript isn't showing up. And you're, of course, very sensitive to what they're feeling. On the other hand, you've got a job to do. How do you handle that?
Well, deadlines are delivery dates, as we call them, are always specified in contracts, but they're rarely kept. I mean, after all, nobody knows precisely when a work is going to be done, and you have to be reasonable about it. If it gets to be unconscionable, so to speak. We had one book that was 12 years overdue, and I thought, well, this is, you know.
Is that a record?
That's a record in my career. And it was actually done in the end.
What was the book?
It was a two-volume, the diaries of Samuel Sewall, who was the Salem witchcraft doctor and the author, the editor. It was an editing job. And he was a man who was lived in Princeton, a marvelous fellow. He since died, but he was 12 years overdue on it, and he just couldn't let this book go. He knew, and it's true. Shortly after it was published, he did die. It's curious, but that's an extreme case. Now, delivery is a technical question, and you know whether the writer is headed towards it, and if it's going to be, you know, 6 months late or a year late, who cares? If it's really, you know, good, if the product itself is worth waiting for.
Let me just reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. Robert Giroux is my guest, and he's one of the most important literary editors of our time. He's now the chair of Farrar Straus Giroux, and he's also written a book, and this is his first book, and it's called The Book Known as Q. It's a consideration of Shakespeare's sonnets. And this book has just been published by Athenaeum. Well, we're talking about egos and all this. There's also an enormous battle of egos that goes on, I think, within writers' circles. Do you try to keep out of those?
Yes, literary politics is hopeless. Stay away from it.
What are some of like the worst battles that you've either tried to mediate or stay clear of?
I can't think of any I've tried to mediate because, you know, you can't mediate. They're hopeless. But I think some writers, I think, make the mistake of politicking, of thinking that if you know the right reviewer, he's going to give you a good review and so on, that sort of thing. Working, intriguing for what you think is going to be a good press, you can't do it. It simply doesn't work. And I advise authors against it. Stay away from it. It's just, that's what I mean by politicking. I don't know how else it would apply, really. You can't politic for the Nobel Prize. You can't, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't collect votes. Pulitzer Prize isn't going to be given to you because, you know, one of the judges and so on is going to be given. Usually, I mean, maybe there have been cases. I don't know of any. I suppose it's humanly possible, considering the way the world goes, but I don't know of any such example. I was delighted when Isaac Singer got the Nobel Prize. I thought it was as marvelous that a writer who writes in Yiddish should, in the United States, be given this prize. And I went with him to Stockholm. He invited me to Stockholm when the prize was awarded, and it was marvelous. He in the Swedish Academy, he read the statement in Yiddish, and then he spoke in English, and it was a great success. And afterwards, the secretary of the Swedish Academy said to me, "You know, Mr. Giroux, this is an historic occasion." I said, "I'm well aware that it's an historic occasion." I said, "It's the first time that Yiddish has been spoken in the Swedish Academy." He said, "Oh, no, no, I don't mean that." He said, "This is the first time that the Swedish Academy has ever laughed."
That's great. You've published a lot of writers' first novels and books of poetry, and you've heard about some writers through other writers who you've published.
True.
And someone like, well, Berryman, you went to school with and mm-hmm. knew him well before publishing any of his work. What do you do? All these instances lead to people who you have to say no to also. Like, I'm sure writers bring in writers who you don't want to publish and that you have former classmates mm-hmm. whose work you don't really want to publish. Are you comfortable saying no? Have you had to learn how to do that? Has it come naturally to you?
No, it didn't come naturally. I used to suffer terribly, and I suffer less now because I know more about it. No, it's never easy, but again, you have to be absolutely honest with yourself and know that the answer is no. And there's a marvelous rejection slip. It's never used, but I've heard about it. It's called the Chinese rejection slip. And I think it actually was used in old China, you know, in the days of the Mandarins and so on. And the rejection went something like this: "Your work is so great that we are not worthy of it. We cannot possibly publish your book. Take it away." We can't quite get away with that, but...
Too bad. That's a good one.
Isn't that pretty good? And you try to be specific. You try to make suggestions of, you know, other possibilities. Sometimes a work is clearly not for your list of your particular house. Our list tends to be more literary than not. And, you know, direct them to other editors. But sometimes they're just bad. You can tell. It's curiously how quickly you can tell. There's an English publisher called Victor Golans, who was an old friend of mine, who's no longer living. And he said he could tell by looking at the first page.
Really?
I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "The conformation of the letters on the page." You know, there's something about a good book that is visually apparent to you right away. And I can't say I go quite, I'm not that good. I have to read at least 10 pages.
Do you always have enough confidence in your judgment to be able to say, this is really not a book worthy of us publishing?
I didn't at the beginning. I was very insecure about that, but I learned it, yes. And you have to know your own limitations and know what you can appreciate. There are certain things that are outside one's own ambit, so to speak. But yes, I'm It took time to learn to do that, yes. And of course, the test is what you like. I remember when I was at Harcourt Brace, I once went into Mr. Brace, Donald Brace, the head of the firm, and I said, "I don't like this book, Mr. Brace, myself, but I think it's going to be a bestseller." And he said, "Look, don't ever kid yourself on that one." He said, "If you don't like it, it doesn't even have a friend to start with. The editor is the first friend that the book has. And here you are telling me that other people are going to like it, but you don't." So he said, "Don't ever take a book if you don't like it very much yourself."
What was the book?
I can't even remember. Huh? I'm sorry, but it was a long time ago. And I don't think it was a bestseller, actually. I remember.
Did you publish it? Or?
No, we didn't publish it. No, we turned it down, and I forget who did it. I just remember that book, which I thought was going to be a bestseller, didn't become a bestseller. But, of course, bestsellers are accidents. I think that whole subject is greatly misunderstood. I mean, it's due to accidents of time and topicality and of the moment. Last year's bestsellers, if you look at them, are books you can't read now. So it has something to do with timeliness and, you know, thinking of the moment. That's true of all bestsellers. There was a study of bestsellers from 1900, and you look at the list and you say, my God, is taste that low? I mean, it's rare that a book, a really good book, say like one of Hemingway's novels, should be a bestseller too. Most of them are junk. And I think that's been true perhaps throughout history. That's not just in America today. And a bestseller cannot be managed. People who tell you, I'll make this a bestseller, are kidding themselves. Can't be done. Many of them are dark horses. The book that's least expected to be a bestseller turns out to be so.
Do you think the quality and sales are usually in conflict with one another in publishing?
Well, they shouldn't be. No, I wouldn't say that. I think quality is absolutely essential to success. If you don't have quality, you might as well forget it. But Moby Dick was a flop in 1855. Melville practically killed himself writing it. He almost went blind, you know. He wrote by candlelight, and he had holed himself up somewhere for a long, long time, and he was almost blind when he finished up, and he knew that he had written a masterpiece. It sold 600 copies. It was a big flop. It did a little better in England, but here it ruined his life. He had to retire and so on. And he's my classic example of a great writer, you see, who doesn't have. And because we now think of Moby Dick as a bestseller, because it's in many, many editions. It's had several movie versions. It's and you know, been on television and whatnot. It was a masterpiece. The timing was wrong. It was ahead of its time. And most good writers, I think, are a little ahead of their time, and the times have to catch up with them.
So you publish it and sit tight?
You publish it and sit tight. The trick is to stay with it until the times catch up. If you really believe in it. That's why believing in it is so essential. And I'm not fooling about this. It's a terribly important part of it.
When did you take a book out of print?
When it stopped selling. It puts itself out of print. Shakespeare's works are famous, for example, for never being out of print. And a classic work is a book that's always in print. It's when a book stops selling, the publisher can't get, you know, it has to be certainly, you know, in the hundreds of copies. If it doesn't sell the hundreds of copies a week, you can't keep it in print because you have to inventory it, keep it in a warehouse, pay storage. It's extremely costly to keep a book in print. But we have a pretty big backlist in our firm. Maybe because the books we publish are books we have believed in from the start.
Well, Farrar, Straus & Giroux is one of the few publishing firms that remains independent. Most of them have been bought by conglomerates or multinationals. Has that been a conscious decision to keep
yes,
out of that conglomerate?
It has. Roger Strauss, who's the president and chief executive of the firm, believes that deeply. And he's had many offers to merge with other firms and from the start, and he simply wants to keep it independent. But there are many. There are about 8 or 9 independent publishing houses in New York now. Charles Scribner's is one. Athenaeum, who published my book, is one. W.W. Norton, a very fine house. They do only publishing. That's what I think of as an independent publishing. Firms that do only book publishing and don't, you know, also own insurance companies, let's say, as some of them do, or become part of a conglomerate of all kinds of other businesses, corporate amalgamations. And it's not easy to do because publishing books in the United States are a luxury in the sense that the first things to go when economic realities become too harsh or tight. Although to me, they're absolutely necessary for life. I don't see how you can live without books, how one can live without books. And we're a literate country in one sense, in that we have tremendous circulations of magazines, and all, but we're not literate in the book sense. England has a much higher per capita rate of reading than we do. The Scandinavian countries do. The Latin American countries do. You go to Mexico City and you see bookstores at every other corner. In big American cities, there are, you know, some bookstores, but they're not as proliferated as they are abroad, and I was particularly struck in Mexico. It's we read, but we read on the run, I mean, writers should have tremendous audiences. Good writers should have tremendous followings and tremendous audiences, but they're looked on as a luxury, and that's wrong. There's something culturally wrong with that. Books should be enjoyed. Shakespeare should be enjoyed.
Do you divide your reading time between reading for work and reading for pleasure?
Yes, I'm always reading for work. You know, there's always a manuscript in my case or a couple of manuscripts to read over the weekend, but I keep up with other books too because I like to read. And it's hard to see what other publishers are doing, what writers are doing. So I read both. I'll read anything, as I say, often say. You can bring it in handwriting. And if it intrigues me, I'll read it. There's no way. Some people say, how do you get a manuscript accepted? So just submit it. And, you know, you don't need an agent.
You really think so?
Oh, I do. I know it's so. And we have done so. Agents are useful. I'm not against agents. Some of my best friends are literary agents. But they're useful. They're good business people. You see, for a successful author needs an agent, but a beginning author doesn't. A beginning author needs to get his first book published, and in fact, you'll find it hard to get an agent. Most agents actually don't want to get involved with unknown or unestablished talents. And they're helpful and necessary, actually, you know, when you get into complicated contracts and movie deals and all that stuff. But I don't think a beginning writer needs a literary agent. I mean, there's nothing against having one, but I don't think it's necessary.
What have you recently read and enjoyed that's already been published?
By another publisher, you mean?
Either.
Well, let me see what I just finished. It's Aunt Julie and the Scriptwriter. A novel by a South American writer. And there was an interview with him in this morning's Times, and I think it's one of the funniest books. He's a well-known writer internationally, but he isn't too well-known to the American public, and it's a delicious book and very funny book, Marvelous Comic Sense, which I highly recommend.
Do mistakes ever come back and haunt you at night? The people who you've turned down or books you've turned down that you shouldn't have, you realize 20 years later or 10 years later?
Yes. We all have skeletons in our closet. But one, the biggest one in my career, I didn't really turn it down, but I lost it by the following process. It was really a heartbreaker. This was right after the war, World War II, and J.D. Salinger was then publishing his short stories in the New Yorker magazine, and I wrote him a note and said how much I liked them, and I said, I'm sure every editor is writing you and asking for your novel. My message to you is not your novel, but your short stories. I'd like to publish your short stories. I received no answer. I'd heard he was a very elusive and reclusive person. I didn't expect really to hear from him. But about 3 weeks later, the receptionist rang my phone and said, there's a Mr. Salinger outside here who wants to see you. And I said, Salinger? She said, yes, Jerry Salinger. I said, send him in. It was J.D. Salinger, very tall, rather melancholy looking. And he said, Giroux, you want to publish my novel first. I finished a novel about a kid in Holden Caulfield. spends the Christmas holidays in New York, and he said, it's almost done. And I said, do you want to change seats with me? You sound like a publisher instead of an author. I said, your stories have to be published. They're terrific. He said, okay, we'll publish the story second. And before that conversation was finished, we shook hands. He said, we have a deal. And the heartbreaker is that when it did come in, and I wrote an absolutely rave report on it, A Catcher in the Rye, my boss at Harcourt didn't like it. And he said, we had a textbook department at that point. He said, because it's about a preppy, I think the textbook department should read this. I said, what have they got to do with this? It has nothing whatever. This is a work of fiction. Nevertheless, he submitted it to them. They said, the reader in the textbook department said, this is not a book for our list. And I should have resigned on the spot. It was very stupid of me not to. I did resign 6 months later. I did leave, and that's when I went to Roger Strauss. But I actually had a contract with that shake of the hand. That was a better contract than a written one, and they didn't back me up. I mean, I just wasn't allowed to publish it, and so that's my my tragic, and not only a bestseller, but a marvelous book.
Yeah.
You know, it was It was one a milestone, and you might say, a book that had tremendous influence. I really was sorry about that one. There are others, of course, but...
Name a couple.
Oh, gosh. I'm sorry, nothing comes into my head right off the bat.
Well, good, I guess I lost that much.
I did Kerouac's first book. I lost On the Road.
Yeah.
That's a complicated story, too. It would take at least 10 minutes to tell you, but it had to do with his own concept of the writing. You know, he wrote it on a roll of paper. In fact, I was supposed to be out in Boulder, Colorado this week. There's a big Kerouac thing going on out there. I had a letter from Allen Ginsberg.
What do you think of his writing, since his writing is so different from most of the writers who you've worked with? Who
Kerouac's?
Yeah.
Oh, it was completely instinctive, and I liked it. I mean, there's no one kind of writing which I like. Is it good of its kind? Is it true? Is he doing what he wants, doing effectively what he wants to do? And The Town, the City was a kind of Thomas Wolfian romantic novel. On the Road was a change for him.
We're really about out of time, so there's just one thing I wanted to ask you. Since the publishing industry has been changing, what kind of balance do you see happening in the near future between the independents, the conglomerate-owned publishers, and the small independent literary press?
Well, I think the independence is important because you're not publishing then for bestsellers, for success. You're publishing because you believe in the book. And I think ultimately the reading public responds to that. I mean, you can't really fool the public. They do know in the end what's good, and it rises to the surface. If it isn't any good, it disappears like so many bestsellers do. And I think we just have to continue to do so. It's always been that way. The genuine article is the genuine article, and nobody's kidding anybody.
I've really enjoyed meeting you. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.